This is Fresh Air. The Republicans are moving out of the White House. Where did their campaign go wrong? We're continuing our behind-the-scenes look at the three presidential campaigns. My guest, Tom DeFrank, is senior White House correspondent for Newsweek. His report is published in the new post-election special edition of Newsweek. He was assigned to spend the past year with the Bush campaign. Newsweek asked the campaign to grant special access under the condition that DeFrank wouldn't report anything he saw or heard until after the election. Although the campaign did not grant special access, DeFrank still kept his promise to not print his story until after the election. I asked him if there were any stories he wished he could have gotten out as they were happening.
I guess there are many stories like that, but one that I would single out is learning that as early as July, Vice President Quayle thought this election was over. And while he was very loyal to the president and did very good work in the president's behalf, and I think probably ran a better campaign than a lot of people around the president, the fact that the vice president told some of his aides in July that we can run a perfect campaign the rest of the way and we'll still lose, that's something obviously I would have loved to have seen in print in July, but the rules were that I couldn't, and so I didn't.
Why did Quayle think that?
He thought, and still does, that this has been a very poorly run campaign, a campaign without a clear focus, a campaign with organizational problems, lack of coordination and cooperation between the White House and the campaign. And basically, he thought this was a timid campaign. It wasn't bold enough. It wasn't aggressive enough. Dan Quayle believes in offense, that if you're not on the offense in politics, then sooner rather than later, you're going to be put on the defensive.
A lot of people felt that the Bush campaign started to derail with the Republican convention. How did Pat Buchanan get such a prominent role within the convention? What happened behind the scenes?
Well, that's one of the untold stories. Basically, the Bush campaign needed Buchanan. The president was always worried about offending the right wing of his party. And so they had to make a deal with Buchanan, and basically Buchanan was going to speak on Tuesday night, but it looked like he might not get prime time on Tuesday night, so he said he wanted to go some other night, and the folks at the Bush campaign said, why don't we put him on Monday night? Reagan is speaking Monday night, so we'll make that party unity night. It sounded good in theory, but in execution, really what everybody in America saw first from the Republican convention was a very harsh speech from Pat Buchanan, which basically said, if you don't think like we do, to hell with you.
So they didn't know what his speech was going to be.
Well, they put out a story that he didn't clear his speech, but the fact of the matter is two of the president's senior officials read that speech 24 hours before it was delivered, and they didn't make any changes to it. So they had a chance. That's contrary to the public belief, but they had a chance to do something with that speech, and they didn't do anything with it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom DeFrank. He's senior White House correspondent for Newsweek, and he wrote the long essay on the Bush campaign for the new special election issue of Newsweek. One idea in the Bush campaign was to send a letter to Bill Clinton on the day of the first debate, demanding that he make public his draft files, which he had earlier said he would do. Who was for that? Who opposed it?
Well, I think everybody was for it, except the president, Bob Teeter, Fred Malek. I think more or less, everybody thought that might be a good idea, because the idea in the first debate was to make some news. But the president just basically did not feel comfortable doing that. The president is a gentleman; he can mix it up, and I know that sounds a little weird, considering just how tough he was in the last 3 or 4 weeks of the campaign, calling Clinton Governor Waffle and Senator Gore Ozone Man, and finally he just started calling him Ozone. But the president just was not comfortable in doing that, and the president did not think it was smart or dignified, and I think he missed an opening. Time and again, there are instances where the president might have been tougher, might have been able to dominate the debate, but for his own reasons, he chose not to do so. He was urged, for example, at one point in the first debate to announce that he'd have a new economic team in the second term, and to announce that he was planning to ask for the resignations of all of his senior government officials, and that Jim Baker was coming back. The only announcement he made was that Jim Baker would remain on at the White House as economic czar. The rest of that he didn't announce, and his aides thought he was going to. He just somehow didn't feel comfortable doing it.
This was during the debate he was supposed to announce this?
This was during the first debate.
If President Bush is such a gentleman as a campaigner, what came over him in those last couple of weeks when he started talking about, bozos and ozone and... It wasn't exactly what you'd call presidential talk. I mean, it was almost adolescent.
Well, at the end of this campaign, I think you saw a declaration of independence from what the president has always called, with great revulsion, the handlers. A couple of weeks ago in an interview, he was saying that he didn't expect to be out of office until 1997, but when he was out of office, he was going to get into the grandchildren business, and he was going to get into the golf business, and he was going to get rid of handlers. He said, there will be no handlers to tell me things like I can't go out in my motorboat because it looks bad. He says, they're going to be gone. When I heard him say that, I said to myself, uh-oh, we're going to see a different George Bush the rest of the way. And I think what he was saying was, I think I'm probably going to lose this thing. And if I'm going to lose it, I'm going to lose it my own way. I'm going to lose it doing things that I'm comfortable doing and I'm comfortable saying, and to hell with these handlers. And he started throwing away his speeches, and he started getting a little hyperbolic, and he overdid it a little bit. I think the American people probably think that bozos is not a word that he should have used, and probably in retrospect he probably feels the same way now. But I think it was a way of him saying, I'm going to run this campaign, and I'm going to bring this thing home my way. I'm not going to be handled any longer.
What do you think the campaign strategists thought of Bush's use of, bozos and ozone and all that?
Well, the campaign handlers were not happy with that kind of language, and they tried to gently suggest to him that maybe he should throttle back. And as a matter of fact, Barbara Bush, Mrs. Bush, felt the same way and told him so. And she was out with him for a day, and it got better. But then when she left the trail, he went back to what he was doing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom DeFrank, senior White House correspondent at Newsweek. There's a new special election issue of Newsweek, and Tom DeFrank wrote the extended essay about what happened behind the scenes at the Bush campaign. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom DeFrank, who is senior White House correspondent for Newsweek. There was a movement inside the Republican Party to dump Quayle. How close did he come to getting replaced? Who wanted him replaced? Who were his supporters?
Well, I don't think the vice president had a whole lot of supporters within the senior command of the Bush campaign. I think Bob Teeter and Fred Malek would have been just as happy to see Vice President Quayle go. They knew it would be a political problem because conservatives would be furious. But I believe if evidence could have been shown that Quayle was a big liability, and I mean a major liability, several questions were added to some polling at the campaign about what people thought about Vice President Quayle, and the results were inconclusive. The numbers showed that Quayle hurt the president, but only by a little bit, and that it was not conclusive or definitive by any means.
You write that the whole Murphy-Brown idea was really Marilyn Quayle's idea. She wanted Dan Quayle to take on the entertainment industry, and that Dan Quayle, in fact, had never watched Murphy-Brown.
Well, the vice president had never watched Murphy Brown, and Marilyn Quayle did have this idea, although it's in fairness to the vice president, he wasn't being manipulated by his wife here. I mean, he has always talked about the values and family values, but it was Mrs. Quayle who came up with the notion of using Murphy Brown as the personification of many of the things that the Republicans didn't like about current lifestyles.
When Quayle started talking about Murphy Brown's decision to have the baby, did his staff know that he was going to do this?
The vice president's staff had several meetings with the vice president in which they talked about how to deal with the Murphy Brown business. This was a calculated strategy.
It was calculated among the people in his staff, but what about the larger campaign? Did they know?
The vice president was pretty good all the way along with letting the campaign know what he was up to. But the vice president figured that the campaign honchos weren't going to like this Murphy Brown business all that much. So campaign got a little bit of advance notice, but not a lot of advance notice. They got a couple of hours notice, and at that point the speech text was already drafted, so there was no way that they could call up in horror and stop it. They tried to get him to dial back, but the president didn't seem to have any problem with it at all. It was the campaign that got all flustered and felt that it was a big mistake.
It was reported in the New York Times yesterday, in a story by Maureen Dowd, that Mary Madeline, the deputy campaign manager, complained to Bush that the party was getting the image of being intolerant and homophobic. I wonder if you knew about that and if you know what the president's reaction was.
Well, the president was told that, and he seemed to be kind of startled. The president is not that way. The president's not a gay basher. The president is not an intolerant person. And he seemed to be somewhat surprised that people would feel that way. But it is true that Mary Madeline felt that way, and some of the other people on his staff felt that way. And by the time it became clear that this was a problem, it was really too late to fix the problem.
One last question. Is there any one thing you could point your finger to that would help describe how the campaign looked different from the inside than it did from the outside?
I always thought that internally the campaign was always in worse shape at any given point than it seemed on the outside. It just seemed to be racked with indecision and power struggles and half starts and indecisions. It was always kind of at sea the whole time. I mean, from the day I started covering this campaign for this election project, it always seemed to me that it was like the last days of Pompeii inside the Bush campaign, even a year ago. It just smelled bad. It just was a place that just seemed like it was going to not work out from the very start. There just was a bad karma in there, and I don't know what happened or why it happened, but it was just not a happy place and not a comfortable place and not a place that seemed to be clicking. The vibes were bad. Very start.
Tom DeFrank, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Tom DeFrank, a senior White House correspondent for Newsweek. Andrew Murr covered the Perot campaign for Newsweek's special post-election issue. He asked for special access under the condition he wouldn't reveal anything until after the election, but he didn't get special access, and like the rest of the press, he didn't get much access at all. I asked Murr about the night it all started, when Perot appeared on the Larry King show and promised to run if his supporters got him on the ballot in all 50 states.
The story had actually started some months before. A lot of people Perot knew, and even people Perot didn't know, were calling him up, writing him, faxing him, trying to get him to run for president. In some cases, they wanted him to run as a Democrat, in other cases as an independent. There was a guy in Nashville, a businessman, sometimes in the news business. He's been a franchiser, a fellow named John J. Hooker. Hooker got interested several months before Larry King in having Perot run for president. Would call him, Perot, and he would talk sometimes three and four times a week. And Hooker, like a lot of other people, was saying, get in the race, you can do it, it can happen. All you got to do is tell the American public that you're doing it, and it will happen. That went on for a long time, went up to about the 1st of February, and Perot called up and said, I'm coming to Nashville, and I'd like to see you. And Hooker said, well, that'll give me a chance to talk to you face-to-face to talk you into this race. By the end of that evening, the two of them had gotten together, and Perot had said, well, if people put me on the ballot in all 50 states, I guess I'll do it. The next day, Perot made that statement in public in Nashville. Didn't really go anywhere. It was published in the papers, but nothing happened. Came another couple of weeks. Perot was to go on Larry King to talk about the President's State of the Union address, and Hooker and some other people started calling King to say, you know, if you press him hard enough, he'll make the same statement, but you really do have to press him. So if you go back and look at the transcript of the Larry King show, you'll see that King asked him two or three times, said, well, a fellow in Nashville named John J. Hooker says that you'll run. Nothing happened. It got down to about 5 minutes left in the show, and King hit him again with it, and he made the 50-state declaration, and he was in.
How much do you think King knew was going to happen? I mean, do you think he figured...
King seemed awfully surprised that Perot was saying no at the top of the show. He hit him as hard as Larry King hits anybody. Three or four times the same question. You wouldn't run, aren't you going to run? So King clearly went into that show thinking that Perot was going to use it as a platform to make the declaration. And in fact, Perot was, but he was going to talk about the economy and he was going to talk about lots of other stuff before he got around to it. One interesting question in my mind is what would have happened had King not come back to that question? Perot let him refuse to answer the question for the first 50 or so minutes of that hour-long talk. And I wonder what would have happened had King not come back at the end of the show and followed it up again.
Andrew Murr's report on the Perot campaign is published in Newsweek's special election issue. This is Fresh Air.